morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Christina Clock, and I'm a member here at Prairie. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or your inabilities. Later in the service, we will invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member or a member of the wider community. And just for the record, we are in a search process for a halftime minister. Today, Dave Johnson will be presenting a service on nuclear energy and current events in Japan. Very timely. Please welcome Warren Hammerstrom and Linda Coletti for the lighting of our chalice.
While I understand the public's fear, I am concerned given the important role of nuclear power. I encourage patience until more information is gathered for a full review so we can learn the lessons, fight global warming, learn the lessons. The cost of fighting against global warming will increase, that is sure. I think it is very difficult to fight global warming, even impossible, without using nuclear power.
It is now time for our presentation, and I would like to introduce Dave Johnson. Dave Johnson is a longtime Prairie member. He spent a career in nuclear power plants, starting out as a reactor operator in California and finishing up as the lead startup engineer on a 1,000-megawatt plant in Taiwan. Today's program will attempt to clarify the events occurring at the Fukushima plant in Japan. Dave will describe some of his experiences in nuclear power and will share his thoughts on the future. There will be ample time for questions, but just a reminder, the program is not intended as a debate about nuclear power. And Dave wanted me to also mention that he made the coffee this morning, so he's a very versatile member.
On March 11th, 2011, at 2:46 p.m. in Japanese Standard Time, an earthquake of magnitude of 9 on the Richter scale occurred 26 miles off the coast of Honshu, which is the main island of Japan. And right on the coast of that thing was the Tokyo Electric Power's Daiichi, which means number one in Japanese, Daiichi Power Plant in Fukushima. And there were 6 reactors there. And at that moment, that whole thing was dead. There was no recovery. It was all over. Now, nobody knew that. But about an hour later, a tsunami came, and it came over a 7-meter wall. I think it was a 15-meter wave that came over. But by then, it was all over. It made no difference. What they didn't realize, and what it's taken a long time to realize, is that that earthquake just shook those plants to pieces, that there's nothing left in there that they could even operate. And they didn't realize that. They thought, well, if we could get power back, we could do something. But in order for power to work, you have to have something on the other end. And as far as we know, there was nothing on the other end. Now, those reactors were so radioactive, no one could get near them. And chances are, no one ever will. The fuel is in there, has been melted. There were 6 reactors. There were 6 spent fuel pools. There were cooling systems for each one of these, and none of them worked, and none of them to this day work. So the radiation was coming up. They tried to get power in. They did get power in. Didn't help. So then I think it started to dawn on them that the reason it didn't work was because the things were just all smashed up inside the reactor. Now, that has never been even considered in accident analysis. It was always assumed that if you got emergency power, you could recover. Not in this case. So the radiation levels are going up. They can't seem to get anything working. Now, the spent fuel pools start to boil, and clouds of radioactive steam are coming up. And so, because they can't get any of these cooling systems working, their only chance, they thought, was to just dump water into these reactors. So they did that. They got helicopters, they dropped water, they got big things. But the problem with that is, it lasts for a little while, but then pretty soon you fill up with water. And this is highly radioactive water. Then you have the choice, what are you gonna do now? You gotta get that water out of there, and you can't dump it in the ocean. So that's about where they are. And it's very difficult to find out what happened there, even for me, who understands quite a bit of this stuff. It's been translated from Japanese. The terms are different. The Japanese tell different stories to different people. So it's not easy, but it seems now that this is just very brief. There are three things. There's the core, that's where the fuel is. There's a reactor vessel, that's the pressure vessel. That's 6 inches of steel all the way around. Then there's a containment vessel, which is a larger annulus on the outside. Now they say that in three reactors, the cores have melted, and they melted through the 6 inches of steel. And they are laying now, they say, down on concrete in the bottom here. Now, I think there's a very good chance that they're not laying there. I think there's a very good chance they just kept going. And now you come to the China syndrome. If these things are melting through the earth, what's going to happen? You know, nobody knows. Will they just keep going and join the magma when it gets to the center? Will they break up? Will they get into water supplies? I don't think so. I think they're just helpless now, and they're just going to have to see what happens. Now, I don't think that the situation there is better than it ever was. I think it's worse. And I think it's getting worse all the time. And I don't think you're going to hear that. For one thing, people's time interests are short. And so, you know, I pick up on this stuff because I'm very interested in it. But most people don't. And they say now that even on number four, there's a chance that that thing is toppling over. That it's broken. Not only has the supports broken, but they put so much water in it, or so much weight, that it's in jeopardy. And if these things happen, it's just going to get worse and worse. And I don't see any real solution to it. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about this. I just want to tell you about this much. This is where I think the situation is. They've tried to recirculate water. They got a 4-kilometer hose. Can you believe that? 2.5-mile hose. And they hooked it up with a pump, and they put a filter in it. They ran it for 5 minutes, and the filter plugged up with highly radioactive material. So they had to abandon that. And I just think that for one thing, they're pretty well running out of people, because people get there's a maximum lifetime dose that you can take. And once you've taken that, you can never be in nuclear power or in any sort of radiation stuff at all. And I'm sure there are a lot of these people who are taking that, have taken that amount of radiation. There's a thing now, they're talking about the Fukushima 50. They say there are 50 men there that have well exceeded their limits, and that they've significantly shortened their lifespan, and they may actually just be dying now from radiation now. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But they're quickly running out of people who can do these things. But you see people go into the near the area and come back out again. They're not coming out to wash their hands. They're coming out because they've had their dose and they gotta go. They can't even stay there anymore. So it's a disaster for Tokyo Electric Power. It's a disaster for Japan. Whether it's a disaster for the world as a whole, and what that implies, I don't know. Now, I want to stop right now, and I just want to see if there are any questions specifically about Fukushima's situation. And then I want to move on to a little more general stuff. What percentage of the overall nuclear thing these plants represent?
Yeah.
I think about 10%. They had 54 reactors. Okay, now they have 48 since these six are done. And last time I heard, there were 17 of them operating. Now they're going through really agonizing reappraisals on what to do on these things. Is there some way they can make higher walls to prevent a tsunami. Is there any point in waiting on it? And I think they just are going through some agonies here, and they don't know what to do. And I think that's true of quite a bit of the world. The whole thing has changed. I don't think they can get in there anyway, because to go in there, you have to go through airlocks. And the airlock, you have to open one door, you go in, you have to close that, and then open the other door. And I would imagine those things are sprung to where there's no way, and there's only two ways in. That's the one I'm familiar with. And I think you, even if it wasn't for the radiation, I don't think you can even get robots to go through these airlocks. It's difficult to know that there's this exclusion zone. Now, whether that is precautionary or whether that is all contaminated, I don't know. You see people, it seems bizarre that you see people all dressed up in this outfit and they get on this bus and they all ride in there and then they get back on the bus again and they go home. And why would you do that? I mean, if it's contaminated, you wouldn't let them get back on the bus. Now the whole bus would be contaminated. So it's a mystery to me. And they let people go back and get things from their homes. And that is something you have to realize, that that plant didn't cause that disaster. That disaster was caused by a natural phenomenon. And that's one big difference between Chernobyl. Chernobyl was caused by poor design, by operator error. This was a natural phenomenon that happened. So, and also, as far as we know, nobody has been killed by this thing. There's some 25, 30,000 people who were killed. They were all killed by the tsunami and the earthquake, not by the plant. Now, whether that's relevant or not, I don't know. You could put like a trap door on the bottom, just dump out. It's nobody knows, and it's a very interesting situation. I certainly have no opinion. I do know that most of this stuff is very heavy, and it would sink to the bottom. But aside from that, I don't know. That's way beyond my... Well, you have to consider that, because I think after Chernobyl, there were people who committed suicide, fearing radiation. Mm-hmm. There were lots of abortions because they were afraid of birth defects. And so they have to be cautious on what they put out. For one thing, there's, I think, an irrational fear of radiation. Plus, nobody really knows. You have no way to detect it unless you have a detector, and most people don't. So it's a trade-off. You know? And the stuff they put out, which I've been reading, is so contradictory. Mm-hmm. And not because they're being, well, maybe they are being secretive, but things from day to day come up, and you learn different things. And so they say that the United States government evacuated citizens within 50 miles, Japan within 20 miles. Well, within 50 miles, there may be, two missionaries and a Peace Corps volunteer, and within 20 miles, there may be 40,000 Japanese. So it's very easy for the Americans to say, well, we'll evacuate all American citizens. There aren't that many. So, the coastline, yes, yeah. I think they are. Now, the one I worked in was on the Sea of Japan. It was on the other side. Uh-huh. And maybe four or five of those are. But as far as earthquakes, I have no idea. Let me tell you who you're talking to here. I'm not a scientist. At one time, one of these science guys told me, he said, the difference between you and me, he said that my knowledge of nuclear power is computational and yours is merely conversational.
Ooh.
And that was a pretty hard put down, but I thought about it. Yeah, he's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's who you're talking to. I don't know. I worked in Little Quas Boiling Water Reactor, which was on the Mississippi River. I worked at Point Beach, which was on the on Lake Michigan. So, and I also worked at Humboldt Bay, which was on Pacific. That happened so slowly, and it was predicted, and everybody knew it was coming. And so it's different than a wave. And like I say, in Fukushima, I think it was that earthquake that just shook it to pieces. And they can't get in there, for one thing. Another thing, chances are these pumps are sprung, thrown off line. There's another thing you can do to try to backfit these plants, and it's called the hydraulic snubbers. And Diablo Canyon in California has these. And so did Takahama, where I worked in Japan. And these are like big shock absorbers that are on all these pipes. There's just a forest of them. And the idea being that not to try to make the thing rigid, but to make it to where it damps out the thing. Now, whether those actually work or not, whether you could take and shake that plant at a earthquake of 9, I don't know. But that's one thing you maybe could do, but you probably can't for most of them, because most of them are old. And most of them are highly radioactive, and you just couldn't get in there and do that work. So, but the other question is how much. They said, and did I say this, that earthquake was supposedly 8,000 times stronger than the one that hit Christchurch, New Zealand.
Yeah, wow.
Now, that's the exponential part of the Richter scale. And any things like that, I would say you talk to John Franz, because John Franz knows a lot more about this stuff than I do. And I don't understand how that Richter scale works. I know it's exponential, but I'm the wrong guy to talk to about that. Now, as far as the Japanese, what could they do? They don't have any coal, they don't have any oil, they don't have any gas. I also worked in Taiwan, same situation. And are they going to go back to rickshaws? They're going to have to do something. The Japanese, I worked with them a lot, and I spent many hours in those power plants with them. And they are an amazing people in some ways, as are the Confucian nations, Japan, China, and Korea, who really, if they get on the right track, they really got something going for them, because they will follow what the leaders say, and they will do, and they will make sacrifices. Of course, when you go on the wrong path, you have World War II. But I know the Japanese, when I was there, even with power shortages, what they would do, they would, at night, they would put those air conditioners up to where, just freezing, to where they would run them all night. And you'd come to work in the morning, you ought to be wearing a parka with a hood. And then during the day, it would gradually warm up, and people would start shedding sweaters and everything. And by the time you left in the evening, you were in your shirt sleeves. But people did this. When things got a little worse, they shut off all the down elevators or escalators. So, and people were willing to do this. And all it took was just the fact that you were Japanese, and this is a Japanese thing, and you should do it. It didn't take any laws.
Do you have something else to present?
Oh, yeah, sure.
I think maybe you should do that so that we can have questions after that.
Okay, what was I going to talk about here? The situation with Germany and France is interesting. Now, Germany has said by the year 2025, I think, they're going to phase out their nuclear reactors. Switzerland has 4 nuclear reactors. They're going to phase those out. France has just allocated $43 billion to build more nuclear reactors. Now, here, I think France may be right, that the Germans are not going to be able to do that. And when the time comes, they're going to have to import power, and they're going to have to import power from France. And it's going to be fossil fuel, and it's going to be nuclear, because that's the only option. Now, obviously, there are people in Germany who think that they can meet these goals, but I think that's what the French are doing. And the French also say that we are not in an earthquake zone at all. And they've never had nobody's ever had an incident like this. So, because of the numbers. Here, last week, it was just miserably hot, and there wasn't a breath of fresh air. Not a breath of breeze at all. You're depending on, like I said, I can't discuss that because I don't know the numbers. I don't want to get in a debate like that. Conversational, not computational. As far as the plants on the coast, that's an interesting thing, because there's Diablo Canyon, which, like I say, has the latest in earthquake thing. There was going to be another plant in Bodega Bay, which is closer to San Francisco. And I was going to go to that plant. I was up in Humboldt Bay. And the NRC put the requirement on that plant that they can show that an earthquake would move 4 feet over and snap back, and there would be no harm to the public. And Pacific Gas and Electric couldn't do that. They covered the hole up, donated the thing to the park, and that was it. So that's what I know about that. It was amazing, back in the 50s, how these countries, the United States, Britain, France, could blow off these hydrogen bombs. They just somehow they could just simply tell the people, we're going to obliterate your island, you got to move out of there. And they could just take a chunk of the ocean and say, we're going to contaminate this. And they did it. And they did it over and over and over again. And I don't know if anybody ever thought about the contamination that was being spread all over the world. So that's just amazing to me that they had the arrogance and the power to do that. It's sort of interesting, some of the things that came along. I started right in the early part of nuclear power, where was something to plowshares, weapons to plowshares, we were going to take the bad things from the nuclear power, from the nuclear blasts, and make power out of them. And there was a time when they designed a nuclear airplane, and I knew a guy that worked on that, and he said they took it out in the Idaho desert and they dropped the reactor out of the airplane, and it didn't hurt it any. But they said the problem was that they had needed so much shielding, so much lead shielding, that the thing was so heavy that it could barely get off the ground. And in order to get the shielding down to where it could get off the ground, the radiation levels for the crew were so great that they could only fly twice They had to retrain him. Now, then somebody else got a good idea not too long ago for a nuclear dirigible. And they thought they could take this thing between the United States and Europe, and it would always fly over the ocean. It would never come over land. It would come here, and helicopters would come up, service it, and come back down. And this would work fine because the thing was so long that you could put the reactor on the other end, and you didn't have to have any shielding. So there were these ideas, and it came along, and they never really went anyplace. I was about the radiation. When we worked, we always had these little dosimeters, which are no good at all in the big, huge levels of radiation they have there. But film badges were supposed to be the definitive thing. We all had a film badge. Once a month, you'd send it in, and they would read it and send the results back. And if you didn't think they were being square with you, you could cut the film badge in half, and you could keep half, so that later on, if it ever came up, you could do it. And there was one time during the, I think it was the 60s, when they made all these fallout shelters. Remember, they didn't actually make shelters, but they designated places as fallout things. And they could give people film badges, and they said, well, the film badge, we could make it so you could look at the film badge, and you could see if you had a lethal dose, that you could see it. And they thought, well, that's not going to work very well. Because people who had a lethal dose might not be real cooperative. So they didn't do that. So there have been a lot of thoughts on this, a lot of ideas. I'm talking about the Japanese. When I worked in Takahama, I worked for Westinghouse Electric Power Company, and we were contractors in that plant that was built by Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. But toward the end of the job, it was still belonged to Westinghouse, even though the Japanese were running it, and so we had to stay in the plant in order to kind of hold the bag. And this is a pretty bad job. You sit there all night. The Japanese are very clannish. And you just kind of watch, you know, to see when they kind of grouped up, you go over and try to figure out what's going on, because you thought at any moment they could just simply dump it on you. It was really your responsibility. And one time, in an 8-hour shift from midnight to 8 in the morning, I made one entry in my log. And it said at 0300, I thought Mr. Ishikawa was going to ask me something, but he didn't. And I thought, that's a hell of a way to spend your life. There's another thing on radiation. Usually these people say that these tumors that develop from radiation takes about 30 years. So there was an article written where it said, well, you know, why don't we get old people and have them work in these places, because it's going to be 30 years for them anyway. And the title of the article was, as long as you're going, would you take out the trash? But now this just came up again, because there was a group of retired Japanese engineers who volunteered for that very reason. They say, we can take a lot of radiation, and so we'd be more than happy to help you if you need that. Yeah, there's a question, and I think that certainly Peter would go along with this. But all this does is to boil water. And you think, is it worth it to make a product like plutonium, which is probably one of the most deadly things known to man and doesn't exist in nature, to boil water? Isn't that ridiculous? And there's a lot of ways to boil water. And sometimes when I would be in these plants, God, it was this huge thing, and we're not boiling water. All we're doing is taking a magnet and turning it around inside some copper wires. And that's what that's all about. And you just kind of wonder if we've gone off the track someplace. And just where we could get back on the track, I don't know. So when I went to Humboldt Bay, we were all power plant operators. We weren't nuclear people. I probably had as much education as anybody. And when PG&E designed that plant, they put jobs up for bids, and for the people to bid, they gave us a bunch of tests, and out of that group, they selected the people to go up there, and I was one of them. But we were strictly power plant operators, because most of the nuclear power plant is just power plant. There's turbines and generators and pumps and compressors, and the nuclear part is really not that big a part of it. But we went through this training program, and then we got to wondering, you know, the company's telling us these things, but is this really true? So at the union, we hired a consultant, the union did, to come up and look us all over, and he said, yes, they are telling us true, and it's a good program. So I went through, I don't know how many of these training programs, and with the way it's set up in the United States, for anybody to add any sort of reactivity to a reactor, you must be a licensed reactor operator. And that means you have to go through this all and take the tests. And the only way that a licensed reactor operator can add reactivity is if he's ordered to do so by a senior reactor operator, which is what I eventually became. And I thought this was pretty safe, because you couldn't just go out and order somebody. You couldn't say, that's what I'm telling you, you do it. Because the operators had a say in that. You had to go out and you had to convince them, you had to talk it all over. So in my experience, safety was one of the main things. And I never saw people that did reckless things. I never saw people who downplayed the risks that we were taking. And yet it wasn't a tough job. I mean, you sat there and normally, with the reactor, the problem is to keep the reactor up. The reactor wants to shut down, and you have to keep it up. It isn't the other way around. It's not trying to control the thing so it goes up the roof. It's designed so that you, if things go wrong, it goes down. And as far as I know, all those reactors in Fukushima, the rods all went in, they all shut down like they were supposed to. There's another question that comes up now on these reactors, where they're the older ones, where they're upgrading them, and where they're renewing their license for 40 years. Now, they'll go ahead and they'll relicense them for another 20 years. And that, of course, is controversial. But if you look at your car, you take your car and after 100,000 miles, the guy looks at it, he says, well, you need tires, you need a timing belt, you can place those things, and that car will go a lot more miles. So I think that probably is not an unsafe situation. As far as the upgrading, well, it's engineering. You maybe do it. What kind of frightens me is that these plants used to be operated by like Pacific Gas and Electric, Wisconsin Electric Power. Now they're conglomerates. They all have NL, EX in them somewhere, and I have no idea who these people are. And what they do, they just run those plants and they just sell that power to the power company. So their whole goal is to just run full speed all the time. And whether they've lost control or not, I don't know. I don't know, deactivate, whether you can ever do that. That's a question that I can't answer. That's a scientific question. But some of the trouble with this, you know, Yucca Mountain, well, nobody wants it in their backyard. But even if you got the people in Nevada to agree, nobody wants those trucks going through their states either. So you have those problems all the way. You can't, and it's all politics. I mean, you can do it.
This is the last question.
Make it a good one. Yeah, that's reprocessing. You can do that. And at one time, that was going to be the thing that they said reactors made more fuel than they used. But it's a nasty process. You have to take sulfuric acid and dissolve these rods, and then you have to run them through all these chemical things. And at one time they were going to do that, and then they said no, because this is producing plutonium, and we don't want people producing plutonium. But it's certainly possible, and it is being done. Now, whether you'll never know what this stuff costs. You'll never know what nuclear reactors in the United States cost, because the government enriches all that uranium, and they're not going to tell you what it costs to do that. And so you're stuck. But yes, you can do that, and I think the French are doing it, and maybe there's other countries that are doing it as well.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
Our closing words will be read by Galen Smith.
One shouldn't minimize the dangers faced by the workers, but even something as catastrophic as the disaster in Japan might turn out to be a lot less catastrophic in terms of damage and loss of life than we fear right now. And you have to weigh that against the health, environmental impact, and assorted other costs of the fossil fuels we rely on every day. And if, like most people, you think climate change is happening and poses a massive threat, you have to ask what options we have. And this is from Joshua Freed, who is director of Clean Energy Program Third Way. I'm not familiar with that organization.
Thank you for coming to Prairie today. please extend the hand of friendship to those around you, and please join us for some coffee and conversation.